Case number 21-1017, Saeed Tlaib v. Stewart Gold. Oral arguments not to exceed 10 minutes per side. Mr. Tlaib for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case is the companion case to the case we just discussed previously. This is the corporate bankruptcy case filed by Mr. Kramer to attempt to avoid paying the judgment received against him after he maliciously and intentionally misused the legal system to try and end my ability to practice law. During the process, the case got converted to a Chapter 7 liquidation, not through the efforts of the other parties, but because Mr. Kramer's attorney entered into an agreement with the U.S. trustee to convert it to a Chapter 7 liquidation after it became abundantly clear that his original filing as a Chapter 11 case, reorganization case, was just a bad faith filing. He hadn't paid the previous bankruptcy, plan payments, and totally disregarded it. There was no indication that he was going to be able to even meet the needs in this case. Right, so it got converted to a Chapter 7 liquidation. Instead of actually reviewing the properties, appraising the properties, and picking out the properties that could actually bring in a lot of money into the estate, the trustee simply abandoned the properties based only on Kramer's undervaluation of the values of the property, which he had every motive to do so that he can claim he has nothing of value. In the record, the Chapter 7 trustee says that they hired a real estate company and that they appraised the values and the value of the properties, and nothing happened. They weren't worth anything. When it was contested in the later proceeding, the attorney for the trustee indicated that the properties were not actually evaluated. They were not appraised. The broker just, I guess, drove by or took a quick look at them and then just said they're not worth it. There's no appraisal. With respect to so there was a lot of issues. I mean, nothing got liquidated is my point. They just abandoned them. And because they abandoned them, and this is why I asked for the case to be consolidated in earlier motions this court, it actually turns out that they no longer had any control over these properties, but still acted in the case as if they had the authority to do what they planned to do with these properties. Later on, it turned out that after it was realized that there was value to these properties, what ended up happening was they just reached a settlement agreement with the debtor to give him back his properties through the other case we just discussed for a fraction of the price. And he got his properties back, and the estate, actually there was no liquidation, is my point. All the talk about equitable mootness and all the talk about constitution make no sense in this case. This case is about professional fees for mishandling of a case that should have been dismissed from the very beginning. And if it wasn't dismissed, it should have been liquidated to the highest bidder, which it wasn't. They have cited no cases at all that state, it is the same argument as before, if you don't name the appellee, then the court has no jurisdiction. They have not cited any cases that stand for that proposition. They've just copied basically the appellee's cites previously and indicated that they're not a party, the trustee's attorney is not a party. That is a misapplication of the law. Because although in my brief it's discussed under FRAP 3C. The courts routinely look to the Federal Courts of Appellate Procedure when there is no issue in the bank, when there is no issue discussed in the bankruptcy appellate cases, because the bankruptcy appellate rules, as indicated by the committee notes, are modeled after the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, and their own cases state, when they're reviewing them, that the courts routinely check and compare them to the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. The Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure do not require you to name the appellee. That's the bottom line. That's how these cases should be interpreted in the bankruptcy context, especially after the rule was revised in 2013 to conform to the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure.
But what I'm not sure I follow the argument. I mean, the Seventh Circuit said that the bankruptcy rules are more demanding. The official form requires more on it than the FRAP does, the official bankruptcy form, more than the federal rules. So why, I'm confused. I was just looking at the text of it and I'm saying, well, you have to list all the parties. I mean, why is it not, it's a more demanding standard, isn't it?
It's not, Judge. In fact, even when you look at former rule 8001A, which actually included the language in the rule that was later taken out in the Federal versus Ameriquest mortgage case, and I'm mispronouncing the name, I'm sorry, Judge. It's the actual case that they cited to. If you look at that case and you look at what the court said, they compare the language and then they say there's some mysterious reason why they're different. And this is with respect to 8001, where the language was in there that you have to name all the parties. And then the court says it does not follow, however, that a strict and literal comprehensive with the rule and form should be deemed jurisdictional in the sense that a failure to comply, however innocuous, spells doom for the appeal. Nothing in the history of the rule in the case law and the treaties discusses the district judge or the appellee's brief suggests that dire irreparable consequence should flow from the difference in wording from the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure and Rule 8001A. All the information required by 8001A was in fact supplied by the appellant, though not in the format prescribed, and presumably conformed substantially, as there is no notice concerns.
What was the name of that case?
That was the case they cited. It's FADAYIRO v. Ameriquest Mortgage Company.
Thank you.
And
I see that your time has expired, and if you're answering Judge Nabandian's question still, that's fine. But
I was judge, and I respectfully request just 30 seconds.
Okay, 30 seconds.
Yes. Thank you, Judge. So, Judge, yes, the Seventh Circuit did say that the language is different and it may require more. But even under the former rule, the courts look to the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure. And in that case itself, it said it does not require anything more than what the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure say. Later on, when the rule was revised to conform with the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure, that's now even less of an issue, because the committee explicitly stated they're changing it to conform with the Federal Appellate Procedure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Majoros?
May it please the court. My name is Elias Majoros, and I represent the appellee, Stuart Gold, the former Chapter 7 trustee of the bankruptcy estate of KBK Properties, LLC, as well as my law firm, Gold Lang & Majoros PC, a non-party involved in this appeal. Today, appellee respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court's December 22nd, 2020 order affirming the appeal, dismissing the appeal of the bankruptcy court orders approving the trustee's final report and the final fee applications. This case is related to the prior case, Keith Kramer, because Keith Kramer was a sole member of KBK Properties LLC, a slum landlord business that owned properties in Detroit, that due to the poor location and condition of the properties and the debtor, KBK Property LLC's failure to pay property taxes due to the city of Detroit and Wayne County, were basically worthless. This comment at the inception of appellant's argument that the trustee failed to review and appraise properties and just abandoned them, that's the first time I've heard of that. That language, that objection was not in the objection that was filed to the trustee's final report. It's not in the brief that appellant filed. But I wanted the court to know that it's true the trustee filed numerous notices of abandonment that were noticed out to the matrix of creditors. Mr. Talib received electronic notice and his lawyers of those notices of abandonment. As the former in-house counsel for this slumlord land business, presumably he was aware of the value of these properties and he never objected to any of those notices of abandonment.
So did Mr. Taleb raise in his objection at the bankruptcy court level this argument about abandonment? You're saying he never raised it in the bankruptcy court? Is that correct?
In his objection to the final trustee's final report and the trustee's fees, all he said was the trustee failed to properly dispose of all the estate's assets. He didn't mention anything here about the failure to review and appraise, and didn't mention anything about how the bankruptcy court approved the abandonment of these properties after notice and hearing, opportunity heard, of which he knew about.
Did he raise this objection in his appeal to the district court?
No. The appeal in the issues on appeal were very odd. In fact, the first issue on appeal was whether the court erred in awarding attorney fees to debtor's counsel where the case was filed in bad faith. There's nothing in here about abandonment of assets or that the trustee inappropriately disposed of assets. It was his sole issue was whether the court erred in awarding trustee fees in a case that was filed in bad faith. The trustee failed to discover relevant evidence, failed to take action regarding undisclosed assets brought to its attention, and acted to benefit of the debtor and not the creditors. Nothing in here about the failure to properly administer property of the bankruptcy estate.
And the basis that the bankruptcy judge used to reject the objection was vagueness. Is that, recapture for me what the bankruptcy judge's ruling was based on?
Yes, Your Honor. The bankruptcy judge said in relevant part the objection, Mr. Taleb's objection, is overruled because in the objection, creditor Taleb makes only very vague and general allegations that are wholly unsupported by any specific details, substantiation, or evidence. Nor will the court give Mr. Taleb more time to supplement this objection. Any such supplement would be untimely. The case had been pending for almost 5 years. The time for Mr. Taleb to have filed any support for his vague, unsupported allegations has passed. And I would also note that there wasn't, even my law firm, Golinga Majoris, the name of my law firm was never even mentioned in the objection filed in bankruptcy court to the final report and the trustee's fees. So we have three issues. The district court's order dismissing the appeal of the bankruptcy court's March 30, 2020 order overruling the objection to the trustee's February 25, 2020 final report. The district court, in our view, correctly dismissed the appeal of the trustee's the approval of the trustee's final report that provides for distribution of all of the estate's assets, constitutionally moot because, as the district court stated, without a stay, the trustee ultimately administered the entire bankruptcy case. The bankruptcy court discharged the trustee and then closed the case. These final reports, which are required to be filed under Bankruptcy Code Section 7004, Subsection 9, and Bankruptcy Rule 3009, are very definitive. It's more definitive and definite than even an order confirming a Chapter 11 plan of reorganization or liquidation, because it is the holy grail of the end of a Chapter 7. It provides for the distribution of all the assets of the estate.
Can I ask a question now? I'm curious. If failure to obtain a stay makes something constitutionally moot, then why is it a factor for equitable mootness?
I think the constitutional aspect of it is more about the court's inability to order effective relief. And a stay is just a factor in that, because once all the money, all the assets of the estate have been distributed to all administrative creditors and creditors, the objection to the final report, it's moot constitutionally, because you can't, it's practically speaking, that none of that money can be clawed back. Perhaps Mr. Tlaib's money, because, you know, he didn't want to stop the distribution of his portion of the funds, but there were six other creditors who got
that,
paid.
We normally, I guess in any normal case, if there's a money judgment and you don't get a stay and it gets paid, you still get to pursue your appeal, right? It's not constitutionally moot. You may have a problem getting the money back if you win, but that's your problem for not getting a stay, right? I mean, we've never said that there's a constitutional problem. Why would there be a constitutional problem in this particular instance?
Your hypothetical is a two-party dispute. In a bankruptcy case that involves multiple parties, including fees and expenses owed to the bankruptcy court, there needs to be finality in bankruptcy. Otherwise, nobody would participate in this if every distribution you get is subject to disgorgement.
Well, but what about his point in the other case, that he's just seeking professional fees? And if he's just going to the amounts that the trustee and that the law firm for the trustee received, why do we need to worry about the other creditors?
Well, because if you were to reverse this and then send it back to the district court, and the district court send it back to bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy state would have to be reopened under Bankruptcy Code Section 350 and Bankruptcy Rule 5010. Somebody'd have to pay a filing fee. There'd have to be a successor trustee appointed, because even if he were to able to litigate the issue of the allowance of these fees, he doesn't get the money. It goes into the pot. Somebody'd have to distribute it in accordance with the priority scheme of the bankruptcy code to all the creditors. He would only just get his pro rata share of that fund, subject to the lien of his attorney.
Yeah, but that would benefit these other creditors. So they presumably wouldn't object to getting some more money.
Well, but who's going to pay the successor trustee and his successor trustee attorney to litigate with me and my law firm over whether or not we're going to disgorge any of our fees?
So he makes the argument that professional fees can be evaluated after the conclusion of the bankruptcy case. And are there any cases that you would cite that would prohibit evaluation of the propriety of professional fees?
Well, first of all, any of such appeal would be futile, right? Because he never even mentioned my law firm in the objection. And unless you...
But can you mention cases? I didn't ask whether it would be futile, but whether there are any cases that say you cannot evaluate professional fees after the closure of the bankruptcy?
I'm not familiar with any cases, nor have I read any cases that allow for review of professional fees in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy case after it's been closed and the trustee discharged and all the funds dispersed.
So there are just no cases on this topic at all, either pro or con?
I don't believe so. You know, we had cited something close to that in that Grecken versus Davis case at 35 APX 826 10th Circuit case, where the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals reviewed and affirmed a bankruptcy appellate panel's dismissal of an appeal of a law firm's fee award by the bankruptcy court under the bankruptcy rules, finding that appellant's failure to name the law firm as a party in the notice of appeal was more than an excusable formality. It constituted a failure of that party to appeal. But we've been relying on the equitable mootness doctrine with respect to the trustee's fees and the attorney fees in the event that the court were to somehow find that the failure to even mention.
Can I ask a question? I thought the Fifth Circuit said that professional fees were exempted from an equitable mootness analysis, that they wouldn't apply equitable mootness when you were basically challenging professional fees, because it wouldn't affect the finality of the plan or whatever the same way that a different challenge would.
Your Honor, I think that case that was had to do with a Chapter 11 case where in a reorganization where the case isn't closed and parties are discharged. I think it's a completely different topic in a Chapter 7 case where the case is entirely closed and the trustee's discharged. I mean, the trustee isn't really even an official party anymore. I mean, we're collateral damage here as a result of this dispute between Mr. Taleb and Miller Canfield that has spilled over into this case. The upside here is $5,000 in trustee fees pursuant to a statutory formula based on disbursements, which I don't see how could be affected in an appeal in any event.
And how much were the counsel fees?
The attorney fees were in total $17,213.50, expenses of $784.72.
Okay, unless there are any other questions, thank you. We appreciate your time, thank you.
Mitch, I reserved some rebuttal time.
Yes, you have rebuttal time.
But sorry for interrupting, I thought you were concluding.
No. Your rebuttal time. Please start.
Hey, Judge. Again, Judge, with respect to the stay issue, this is just a red herring. I want the court to realize. Well, not really.
Excuse me.
I want the court to examine.
Judge Clay has a question.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting you. I'm just wondering, is there sort of a jurisdictional problem with this case in that some of the arguments go to whether the bankruptcy estate should be reopened and money clawed back to pay professional fees and things like that. And the creditors of the bankruptcy estate have not been sued or notified of these proceedings, and I'm just wondering if maybe this entire case might be jurisdictionally defective because the creditors who might be impacted here of the bankruptcy estate have not been given notice of these proceedings.
I understand, Judge. It's a good question, but absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. This has nothing to do with other creditors. What they're saying is, in order for me to get relief, I have to reopen the case, I have to get a successor trustee, I have to do all this stuff. That doesn't need to happen.
I know the issue is contested, but the creditors are not here to have their say on that.
I'm going to get to that, Judge. All that needs to be done, all that could have been done and should be done, was with respect to the constitutional mootness, was the court just remand the case to the bankruptcy court and have the actual hearing with respect to professional fees, and that's it. and it doesn't affect the creditors at all. There's no successor trustee that has, it's just a motion, Judge.
But assuming that we agreed with you that we should remand to the bankruptcy court and have a hearing on professional fees, aren't there going to be costs of having that hearing, and who's going to pay those costs? People have to prepare?
The professionals, like the trustee and the trustee attorney, are not allowed, and specifically are not allowed to recoup expenses for having, for arguing a motion where they're asking for attorney fees, and it's challenged. And it's, there's no expenses, so they can't even claim expenses. All it is a motion to justify their what happened in the case. And with respect to that, there are no expenses involved with respect to other creditors. It's only limited to the professional fees on purpose. And it's just, the court could have just remanded back to the bankruptcy court to have the hearing. With respect to the state issue, Judge, I was beginning to talk about it. It's a red hearing. If you were to believe their argument that a stay, I need to file a stay, and I did it, and therefore there's constitutional immunity, equitable immunity, just remember who controls the bankruptcy case. The trustee and the trustee's attorney at any time can close the case out. And if they're the ones who direct went, they knew it was on appeal and then closed it out knowing that it was on appeal, and with respect to the distribution, they distributed the funds before the time for appeal had already run out. So even when I filed an appeal, their actions, who control the state issue, prevented me in both cases from filing for a stay because they distributed the money right after the order was filed.
Okay. We have taken these two cases way beyond the time that was allotted, but we thank you for your argument, and we thank the counsel for Gold for his argument, and unless there are any further questions, the case will be submitted. So thank you. Thank you both for your argument. Good.